Hi, this is John Amato from CooksandLiars.com, and I'm joined by a columnist from CQ Weekly at MSNBC and an early show opinionator, Mr. Craig Crawford.
Hello there.
Mr. Crawford, how are you?
It's great to talk to Crooks and Liars. It's my favorite name for a blog.
Who would have expected, right? Do you think there's any crooks and liars out there?
Yeah,
politics
it worked out great for you. Now we got all these, got Scooter Libby indicted. You might have some convictions and have actual crooks to talk about. We've always known we had liars to talk about.
Now some crooks. Yeah, I never expected it to resonate so well, but it has. And, thanks for coming on. I know you have a brand new book called Attack the Messenger, and I want to talk about that. But first, I just want to get a quick reaction from what Harry Reid did today.
Yeah, Democrats finally get a backbone. Actually, I act like they're in the Senate for once. I think maybe this is a sign of things to come. A lot of it's because, Bush's approval rating's down, Republicans on the run. I think Democrats see an opening, and it was an interesting move. It was a pretty clever little parliamentary trick.
I agree. It is a lot of us on the Democratic side have felt that the Democrats have been sort of not speaking out when the speaking is good, so to speak. And this was a really surprise move. I thought Harry Reid's been doing a pretty good job, but today in his press conference afterward, he was feisty. Did you happen to catch that?
Yeah, I did. I clicked it on Crooks and Liars. That's where I watched it. And the thing is, it reminds me of. I got such a kick out of the Democrats' way. This goes back a ways, but back to 1992 when they were gearing up to run against the first Bush president when he was up for re-election. And all the Democrats, except for one or two, were shying away from any personal. They wouldn't even say Bush's name because he was at 90% approval. So they, and a lot of the grassroots were mad. They won. Tom Harkin was one of the only ones who would get out there and actually attack him by name. You remember he used to say George Herbert Walker Bush, and even Bill Clinton then wouldn't. He might criticize the administration, but never the president. Well, then when Bush Sr.'s approvals went down, then all of a sudden all the Democrats got feisty, and that's kind of what I see happening now, is Bush is, they're not as afraid of him now because of these approval ratings down so far.
I think that also happened during their Democratic the convention, because there was this feeling that don't attack President Bush in their convention, and then what happened is when it was time for the Republicans, they just destroyed John Kerry. They swift voted him in their convention, and then George Bush had this huge, rise in the polls.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you decide you're going to pull your punches in politics, you need to think long and hard about it, because in today's politics, that probably isn't a good idea.
For sure, and of course, Bush 43 was reelected, and the rest is history. And now I believe the American people are seeing and getting what they voted for. But going on to your book,
That's what's so interesting about the Supreme Court nomination. I believe that President Bush has no choice but to appoint someone who would vote to overturn Roe and take the conservative stands that this nominee Alito probably will, because that's what he campaigned on. That's what he got elected for. My message to people who don't like that is, especially the ones who didn't vote, I guess, is this is you get the democracy you deserve. That's what democracy is all about.
And that did not come as a surprise. What came as a surprise was the Harriet Myers nomination, and what was very fascinating was to see the conservatives eat their own and just throw her under the bus. And to me, it was the whole up or down vote issue that they brought up, to me, became so hypocritical, and they lost any credibility in that argument because they just destroyed her, where she had to pull her name off the table, and then they act like, she pulled it off, we didn't. I mean, how do you feel about her nomination?
I sort of like the fact that I'd like to see more justices with life experience beyond the law school library, which is what we have. I mean, I do like the idea of some people with a little more variety in their backgrounds, which is one thing I found appealing about her. But when you started reading her writings, that's when I got off the reservation. Because a Supreme Court justice, I went to law school. I studied constitutional law and everything. And there's just nothing worse than poorly written Supreme Court opinions, and there are lots of them out there. And that's where I got off her ticket. I just thought, you know, I don't think this woman can write well enough to write opinions that poor law students can understand.
Yeah, what came out was not very favorable to her, but it was just the attack from the, I call them the extreme right, which just, she did not fill the need. Their litmus test, which they always said they don't have one, which was they weren't certain if she would overturn Roe v. Wade if it came up for a vote, and they just crucified her. But
yeah,
now,
I think they were ready to give the White House a licking and show them who's boss, too. I think there was a lot of that. I think she really got caught up in a whole lot of political stuff going on that in some cases wasn't really even about her.
No, I mean, you don't nominate your personal lawyer. It's immediately, you know, you think of FEMA Brown, and I actually did a headline when FEMA Brown appointed to the Supreme Court, and everybody for a second even believed it. But anyway, getting to your book, which I really enjoyed, for everyone out there, it's to the point. It's not 500 pages, but you make your arguments are well founded and interesting. The first story you talk about, it's called Turning the Tables, and it was fascinating to me. Would you tell the listeners really what that's about?
Yeah, it goes back to the 1988 campaign. I call it the day the politicians declared war on the media, which was a bit of a device. I mean, politicians have been at war with the media for a long time. I know that. I even go back to Thomas Jefferson, and he was one of the originals to attack the messenger and make it work. But in that campaign, George Bush had a problem. He had the Iran-Contra scandal of the Reagan White House and many questions about his role because he was vice president. They had run this rogue foreign policy, selling arms to Iran, illegally diverting the funds to pay for a war in Central America that Congress wouldn't authorize. And there were many questions about, given his background in foreign policy, it was assumed he must have known about it, but we didn't even know at that time if he did know about it, if he'd opposed it internally or anything. So Dan Rather wanted to do an interview on evening news, interviewing the vice president on the eve of his announcement of presidential campaign. And so that was problem number one that the Bush campaign had to deal with. They wanted to get Iran-Contra off the table and behind them. The other thing is, just a few weeks before that, Newsweek had put out a cover story, The Wimp Factor, getting into all this discussion at the time that Bush might not be tough enough to be president. So they go into this interview on national television, and they just bicker like a couple of junkyard dogs, and nothing's accomplished. And at the time, people thought it was all Rather had been rude and disrespectful to the vice president. And I had always thought the campaign, the Bush campaign, which was run by Roger Ailes at the time, who went on to found Fox News Channel and runs it today, I'd always thought they'd gone in there with that agenda. And one day at CBS in Washington, taping for something else, I tell this story to journalism students, which the book's getting assigned in a lot of journalism classes, so I'm going to a lot of colleges, and I tell them, you know, this is a lesson, and always be open to, you never know where you're going to get information for a story, where it comes from. Because this cameraman, while I was down there doing the interview, spoke up, and he says, yeah, you know, I agree with you. He says, I always thought that was a setup. He said, because Roger Ailes was standing there with a cue card. I ran the camera. Roger Ailes had a cue card to prompt Vice President Bush to attack Dan Rather, which I thought then, oh, well, that makes my chapter. That's just what I needed. I got that from the cameraman.
It's just, and it captures the whole attack, the messenger, where they planned to make, because they hated Dan Rather to begin with, and immediately they turned the table on the reporter. And you know, even today when talking heads discuss it, rarely do you hear the fact that it was a setup. And it just, it was so fascinating to me. I didn't know that fact. And it was so orchestrated, and that's why so many people have a problem with Fox News and Roger Ailes. He does it with his Fox facts. You'll be seeing a debate, and in the bottom, you'll see, why do Democrats hate this woman? And there's a picture of Janice Rogers Brown.
I mean, it's, you know, the attack the messenger techniques are they're sometimes kind of brutal, but for the most part, they're very subtle, and it's all about not looking like it's a strategy. Like, it's just, you know, it's just serendipity, and that's what I try to deal with in the book, is what I've seen over the years is some very, very sophisticated strategies, techniques employed to divert the public's attention from the subject at hand and get them focused on whoever's asking the question. You know, when I was growing up, I remember, you know, sitting around my folks watching them Meet the Press or something, and a politician would dodge a question, and people would say, well, he didn't answer that question. What's the answer to that question? Nowadays, there's more of a tendency for people to say, what a rude question. You know, who is that guy? Well, is he a liberal, conservative? You know, all the focus on the reporter asking the question instead of the politician dodging the question.
And you also have a nice little chapter dedicated to Helen Thomas, who is that reporter that does ask those questions. And,
yeah.
And is she a dying breed? Do you see a resurgence of this in the press? But what's your feelings about Helen Thomas?
Well, I think Helen, you know, now she's a columnist, so she's a little more opinionated. She got out there and, you know, got quoted a couple times bashing Bush pretty good. I think at one point said he was the worst president she's covered, and she's covered him since John Kennedy, or actually even worked in Washington since going as far back as World War II. So that was saying a lot, so he was saying it's the worst one she'd ever covered. But she's a columnist now, so she got a little more freedom to say that kind of thing. And but going back to her press briefings with Ari Fleischer up to the Iraq War is what I really dove into for the book. I read most of the transcripts of those briefings, and it's remarkable to see how she was almost alone in the White House press corps in those months leading up to the Iraq War, invasion of Iraq, but in asking about the consequences in a way that we are asking now. I mean, we weren't asking these questions in the press corps except for her in those days. Now everyone is, and it's a little too late, but she at least got in there and tried. And of course, the response was the White House tried to throw her off the front row of the daily press briefing. They eventually relented on that. But President Bush quit calling on her at presidential press conferences, and the first president since Kennedy, the first one she covered, just not to ask her, not to call on her to ask a question, because he doesn't like her questions.
Well, you know, why ask Helen Thomas when you have Jeff Gannon?
Yeah, I mean, and of course, that was the other thing. Their excuse for moving Helen Thomas to the back row of the press briefing was that she's not a wire reporter. She's a columnist now, and, you know, they seem to have all these standards of professionalism, and then, but at the same time, they were credentialing Gannon to come into the White House press corps. Yeah, I talked to a Russian journalist at that time when she was moved to the back row, and he said he was back there with her one day and didn't realize what had happened, and he said to her, why are you back here in the back of the row? You're Helen Thomas, why aren't you up front? And she told him what had happened, and his response was, my God, this sounds like Soviet Union.
Well, you know, why do you think it is that the press at that time did not ask the tough questions, the questions that you point out in this book that are so important for the public discourse? Why did they roll over?
Yeah, I think there were several, but the one that I think overrides is fear of the public. It's something I see a lot, and it's as disturbing to me as any of the other problems we talk about, but because when the media sees the public rallying around something like they were that war, there is a great fear of going against the grain, that people would view the reporters as not patriots, as, or even worse, as treasonous, you know, if they were to ask these kinds of questions. And all those accusations were made against Helen at the time. Even her sanity was questioned. And so I think there's some degree of fear in that. And now we're seeing the media much more aggressive about covering the war. Maybe not as aggressive as some would like them to be, but some of that is because the war's less popular now. The president's less popular now, and it's easier for the media to do that without a fear of retribution. And I think that's dangerous, though, when the media starts following the polls like politicians do.
It is, and I remember when Jon Stewart was on Crossfire, and he just told them, you're hurting us, you're hurting America, and they looked at him dumbfounded, but his point was that you're not talking about substance, you're having these debates right and left, but why can't we just have the truth? In other words, if someone sells a lie, why can't a reporter from NBC, from CBS, ABC say, Dick Cheney just lied there, or John Kerry just lied there? Why can't they do that?
The word lie is not used enough in Washington. Washington has come to define it in such a restrictive way that, you know, it almost has no meaning. I mean, today in Washington, you know, when somebody lies, no one wants to use that word, and I really don't understand it, because it's, you know, to most people, to me, I say in the book, my definition of a lie is any intent to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the trouble with that definition is we all lie all the time. But, you know, I'd rather have a definition that means something than one that's so restrictive that it never means anything.
And it's almost, you know, they view it like a curse word.
Yeah.
You know, and you also, and then leading into that, you have a little chapter about spin, and just the idea of having a spin alley.
Yeah.
Is repugnant. I mean,
institutionalized in Washington, this idea of spin, and people laugh about it. It has this cute little name, and in my view, it's propaganda. It's what we used to call propaganda, except now we've got this cute name for it, so it sounds more like a cuddly animal than what it really is.
And it also seems the way, even with the 24/7, where they've melded opinions with news, and now you're not really sure if it's news or opinion. And so it can distract people from what the real story is. And what is, you also have another thing you call the Dover test. What is the Dover test?
Yeah, this was something that it's a phrase that the military came to use after Vietnam. And any time a conflict was contemplated, the military would say, does it pass the Dover test? And what that meant was that in Vietnam, one of the reasons the public, or at least in the view of the military, that the public lost faith in the war is the site, the video of the returning caskets. And Dover, Delaware is the base where the soldiers' caskets would come. And at the beginning of this war, somebody figured out how to deal with the Dover test. The White House and the Pentagon issued an edict to Dover and some other military bases that receive caskets, announcing that they were no longer to allow any photos, any video, any coverage of these returning caskets. So it was such a simple solution. It was amazing that it took so long for them to find it, because you hear all these military people for years been wringing their hands, you know, we can't go into conflict unless it passes the Dover test, because if they see the returning bodies, they'll side against us. And here the Bush administration comes along and says, well, okay, fine, we just won't let them see the caskets, and then the Dover test is no longer a problem.
Mm-hmm. And again, when you see those images, and what's happening now, obviously with 2,000 deaths and more, seeing more of that, it resonates in the country, and Bush's poll numbers are directly affected, and journalists are allowed. You're actually saying the White House is stopping journalists from doing their jobs.
Yeah, and what was even worse is the media's response. I mean, the traditional media didn't respond to this. They just fell along with it. Now, just to be historically accurate, the Clinton administration had started trying to do this, but there was no conflict that resulted in this many bodies, so that it wasn't as much of an issue. But the media did not respond. What's amazing is it took a blogger to get out there and file a Freedom of Information Act complaint, and what he turned up, I believe it was Smoking Gun, if I'm correct, and what they turned up was that the Pentagon was itself taking photos of these caskets. So through an FOI complaint, they made the government ultimately release these photos. So the photos got out, but not because the media ever did anything. It was because the Pentagon took the photos, and a website night filed an FOI. I mean, it was just a... So I conclude that chapter by saying the media failed the Dover test.
They did. And, you know, now to get off your book, you are now in the blogosphere, and you have a website, and it's called crawfordlist.blogspot.com. How are you enjoying blogging?
Yeah, I wrote about the blogging in the book, but I've learned a lot more about it since, and I see a couple of trends in the blogosphere. One is that I think that it is becoming a great organizing tool for liberals that they just didn't have before. I think it's magnifying the impact. We saw it in some off-year election, and I think we're going to see it in elections to come. And another factor is that it allows a forum for liberals to beat up the media, which up until now, the conservatives were pretty much owned that turf. And as a result, a lot of media people, I think, were getting bullied by the conservatives because they were so effective on the internet about rallying people and sending emails and, you know, and pressuring media that they weren't hearing from the left, so they were assuming that, you know, that the left wasn't there. And now I think we're hearing from both sides, largely because these blogs are helping to rally the liberals to go after the media, which they often deserve, and it's good for them to hear complaints from both sides.
I agree, and the bottom line is what we all want is them to report as truthful and as accurately as possible, and we try to hold their feet to the fire. And that's I do a lot of media criticism, and it's frustrating when the same talking point that, oh, Dick Cheney, you know, Joseph Wilson said Dick Cheney sent them to Niger, which is wrong, and you hear it repeated over and over again. And the fact when we get to express those opinions, it does filter down, and it is becoming a pretty powerful tool. But I don't want to keep you on anymore. I know that you're tired traveling around, and I really appreciate the time and you coming on, and it is, I really enjoyed the book, and I recommend it for anyone. I'll post about it and link to your website so people can check it out. And thanks a lot, Craig. Good luck. Hopefully I'll see you on Countdown soon. When's your next appearance?
Well, we'll try to deliver more crooks and liars from Washington for you to talk about.
All right. All right, Craig. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Okay, bye-bye.